From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. An idea that is not dangerous is unworthy of being called an idea at all, according to Oscar Wilde. And the 1996 film Crash definitely contains some dangerous ideas. It's all about people who are sexually aroused by car crashes. It's a film that gives new meaning to the word autoerotic. I'm Jim Fleming. We'll look at profoundly disturbing films such as Crash today as we explore the world of ideas. Also, B.S. Johnson's ideas for the future of the novel and how the idea of language spreads around the world.
The room is moving.
Peter Watson is the author of a book called A History of Thought and Invention, From Fire to Freud. Watson uses three big ideas to organize his history of ideas, one of which is the idea of the soul, as he told Steve Paulson.
I mean, I could have said that the greatest idea is God, but I wanted to draw attention to the fact that the soul, the concept of the soul, brought with it a whole technology. Prayer, notions of limbo, purgatory, and so forth, that enabled priests and bishops to control their laity. And this was a very interesting phenomenon, accounting for a lot of sort of medieval, pre-modern life. And moreover, the notion arises in the medieval times of what was then called in Latin homo duplex, that human beings are in fact two entities. There's our corporeal body, which we see around us and deal with all through our earthly lives. And then within us, there's the immaterial and immortal soul, which is not only immaterial and immortal, but carries with it the implication that it is in some way better than our mortal soul, and that if we can only get in touch with it, our soul will be ennobled and we'll have a better place in the hereafter. And I was interested in this because it seems to me that this is what has lived on, although we live in a more secular world than was true 100 and 200 years ago. Since the age of Freud, essentially his concept of the unconscious and of the id and ego and so forth is a modern notion of the soul, that within us, I mean, we live in now what's called the therapeutic society, and we argue that if we can get in touch with our inner self or our real feelings, we'll lead a much happier life.
That's a fascinating take on Freud, because, of course, he was an atheist and quite critical of religion, but you're saying, in a sense, he operated within the same paradigm.
Oh, yes, I think very much so. I mean, the philosophy of the unconscious was a German phenomenon from about the 1860s. So it wasn't original to him, but his division of the self into the three, ego, superego, and id, was yet a secular trinity, if you like. And the way they're linked is just as mysterious as the earlier trinity. But yes, it's a parallel notion that if we can get in touch with our real feelings, I mean, we accept, most of us do, I don't, but most of us do, that we have these inner feelings or this alternative self within us. And if we can only get in touch with it, in some way our neuroses will go away, our problems will go away, we'll be much more happy and comfortable with ourselves. And this is essentially a secular notion of the soul.
Now, are you willing to put some value judgments on some of these big ideas? For instance, the soul? Can we isolate what has been good about that idea and what perhaps has been damaging?
Well, I think that the damaging thing about the soul is its ambiguity, the fact that, you know, it's very difficult to pin down what it is, and this gave the church immense control over people and also led to the fact that heresies were regarded as bad when there was no way of proving it one way or the other. So that led to a lot of inhumanity and cruelty. I think that, on the other hand, the notion of the soul and what might happen to it in the afterlife did lead many people to behave better, to be more honest, to work harder. The old Protestant notion of the work ethic owes something to that concept, I think.
Uh-huh. Now, another one of your big ideas, one idea that you say has shaped human history, is what you call the experiment, science, which I suppose very much came up in reaction to religion.
One way in considering the history of ideas is to say there are two kinds of thought. There's looking in, which has given us religion, philosophy, psychology, and there's looking out, which has given us travel, science, business, and so forth, trade. And I am very much a looking out man. And I think that it's this change from looking in to looking out which takes place by and large, most influentially in Western Europe in the late or high Middle Ages, that has really now shaped the world. I mean, we essentially, the man, Robert Grosseteste in Oxford, who had the idea in the 11th century that in order to find out about phenomenon, we should subject them to systematic testing, that is an experiment. And that has led to, you know, in time, to a very, very powerful way of looking at, studying, exploring, discovering, and controlling our world around us. And obviously the main difference between the modern world and the world that existed before is science as a result of the experiment, which led in time to the Industrial Revolution and the mass society that we have now.
And I suppose if we wanted to try to pinpoint the origins of the scientific revolution, well, we probably would go back to Copernicus, placing the Earth not at the center of the universe, but as one of many planets revolving around the sun. And then Galileo, he came along and corroborated a lot of what Copernicus had found. And that, of course, had profound implications on religion.
Yes. I mean, I think that there are several starting points to the scientific world. I mean, I think you have this period from, let's say, the 11th century up until the Industrial Revolution, when I think science and pseudoscience and science and religion exist side by side. I mean, you're right about Copernicus and Galileo, but even a little later with Newton. Newton, we now know from the recent scholarship, was not just the first of the scientists, if you like, the first of the moderns. He was always the last of the ancients. I mean, he believed in alchemy. He believed that there were clues in the Old Testament to the shape of heaven, and he was trying to find this out. He believed that Moses had discovered his law of gravity all those years before him. So he was, although a hard scientist in one way, rather a mystic in another way. So there was this crossover time.
And that's true with a lot of those early scientists. I mean, those great fathers of the scientific revolution. Copernicus himself was a man of God. I mean, you can go through all of those people, those early founders, and they all had tremendous belief in God.
I mean, for me, the most interesting thing, particularly speaking, you know, on an American radio show, is that all the German, French, and British scientists who discovered the great age of the Earth in the late 18th and early 19th century. This is before Darwin came along, okay? Before Darwin, before the first hard thoughts about evolution. The people who discovered that the Earth was not just 10,000 years old, but hundreds of thousands, and then millions, and then billions of years old, were all very, very profoundly religious people. Christians in this case. And so the idea that the Earth is very, very ancient, without which you could not have Darwinism, the idea that the Earth is very, very ancient was not the idea of some secularists. It's the ideas of very, very religious people who decided that the evidence showed that that bit of the Bible could not be true.
So what are the, I mean, given that history and given all the tensions that exist today between science and religion, which we see played out all the time now, what does this suggest about the relationship between science and religion? I mean, does there need to be the tension that is so evident today?
I think there does. I mean, I think there's a deep philosophical divide here, which is curiously modern. I mean, the Italian philosopher Vico was the first person to point this up, which is that on the one hand, we think we know what is going on inside us because it is inside us. We know how we feel about things and so on. We know that the world that we have created, the books, the paintings, is our world. Yet, when you look back, that achievement may be splendid in terms of what you look at and so forth, but the world in which we live is increasingly the world of science, which the Vicoists say, well, you can't know that world as well because it's out there. And yet, that's not true either, is it? Because we can control the world very well through science. And so if planes stay in the air, you are talking to me thousands of miles away, the technology works. And so there is, I think, an inherently broken back nature about being modern, which is ultimately irreconcilable until the scientists find out in scientific terms what it means to be conscious. And, you know, at the moment we don't even have a language as to how to talk about this. Some philosophers or scientists, psychologists say, well, there's nothing to explain. It's like parallel processing in computers. And others say, well, that's rubbish. That doesn't really explain anything. But I do think it's a good question that there is this division between us. And I suspect that we'll go on, one philosopher put it, shifting uneasily from foot to foot as we consider this problem.
Now, you clearly come out on the side of science in this whole age-old debate between science and religion. And I guess I'm wondering if you think that science has replaced religion as a viable idea in the world today.
Yes and no. I mean, it has replaced it in terms, for me, of the intellectual excitement. I don't think most people think that science is as passionate as people thought that religion was passionate in the past. And it seems to me that we have the following problem, that there is religion, which for someone like me is just old hat. There is science, which I find fascinating, but I can see that it doesn't motivate or move people. And then in the middle, we have the arts, which do move people and for the most part are now, it used to be very religious, the arts, but now it's very secular. But I have a problem with that too, because although the arts move many people, if you and I had been having this conversation just over 100 years ago, then we would have taken it for granted that the arts could tell us the truth as much as the sciences. Now, what happened in the 20th century, in my opinion, is that the authority of the arts collapsed, and we now no longer look to the theatre or the film or the novel or to painting to tell us the truth in any deep or meaningful philosophical way. They entertain us, and that may be enough. But it seems to me that we're living in a world where religion has no meaning, where the arts have no meaning, where science has a lot of meaning, but people are sort of unmoved by it.
Well, let's talk about your third great idea, what you call the West, or you might call it Europe,
yes,
which is really about a new idea of government.
Yes, I mean, I do mean the West, really, but it so happens that it occurs in Europe. It's just a set of, say just, it's a set of changes that takes place, and it varies from little things like the invention of musical notation, which makes music so much easier to produce and reproduce, to changes in worship, which make people much more individual, to changes in letter writing, which means that people can express their feelings and how they can express their sense of individuality more. It concerns the invention of the clock, the mechanical clock, which creates the working day as we know it, and from that pushes trade and industry forward. The inventions of the spectacles, which makes reading far more widespread. A whole set of changes takes place in Europe at this period, And life basically stops being medieval and begins to be modern as we understand it in any kind of recognisable way. And it seems to me that we now think that we are living in interesting times, but that would probably have been a very interesting time. I mean, one Oxford historian, for instance, said the most interesting time to have lived in were 1050 to 1250, when the changes that I've just been describing were taking place, and 1750 to 1950, when you have all the great changes of the Industrial Revolution, modernism, particle physics, the expanding universe, and so forth. And that these changes, the car, the aeroplane, television in that latter period, these changes are much greater in terms of psychology and sheer change than anything that's happening now.
Peter Watson is the author of A History of Thought and Invention, From Fire to Freud. He talked with Steve Paulson. Could argue that one of the greatest ideas of all time is the idea of language. After all, that's how we communicate, and that's what we use to express our ideas. Nicholas Oestler would probably agree. Oestler's the author of Empires of the Word, A Language History of the World. He says that there's often a correlation between wealth and the spread of languages.
Show me the money is quite a good way of looking at it. I mean, why was it that when Latin came to the end of its dominance through the fact that learned people were not sufficient to sustain it, and this happened in the middle of the 15th to the 16th centuries. Why was it that French was the language which then came out to be the most prominent international language? The only explanation that I can see is because French was the language of the strongest and certainly the richest power of Europe at the time. I think this is what you're going to see as China grows in per capita wealth. Its culture will become more and more a focus of prestige. I mean, we've already seen that happen in a small way with Japanese in the second half of the 20th century, so that people now have heard of sumo and sushi, and those Pokemon gotta catch 'em all children's heroes are based on sumo contestants. When a country becomes a force to be reckoned with economically, one tends to see its culture becoming attractive all over the world. And with it, of course, the language will come.
One of the things that's interesting to me about all of this is that so far in all of the transitions that you've described, the inherent nature of the language itself seems virtually unimportant compared to the force of emigration, the force of capitalism, the force of military might.
Well, I think there's a limit to that. It's an interesting point. I mean, and that is the sort of dogma of linguistics, really, that it makes no difference to the fate of a language what sort of grammar or structure or propensity to borrow vocabulary that it may have. However, I think you can see that that is limited in the sense that languages spread more easily over other languages which are more similar to them. This we can see in the case of the rapid advance of Arabic across the world, out of the Arabian deserts, to the east as far as Afghanistan, and to the west as far as Spain, and right up to the Pyrenees Mountains, in the 7th century AD. That happened. Arabic got itself established all the way along there and was spoken for, I don't know, 3 or 4 generations. But the fact is that only in the center of that zone, which is a pretty large center, I may say, all the way along North Africa and in the Middle East as far as the borders of Iraq, only there did it actually stick and is it spoken to this day. And if you look at what was there before, those were all relatively closely related languages to Arabic. Where the languages were very different, whether it was Persian out to the east, or forms of Romance, which they call in the time, we now call it Spanish and Catalan and such languages, in the West, where that somehow Arabic was not so readily taken up. So I think there is a tendency, there is a certain resistance which can be seen, which prevents languages from being taken up, even when you might think they could easily be taken up?
Well, this raises the question of whether English and Chinese, for instance, have enough in common that one or the other could get dominance over the other. It hasn't so far. They seem so different from each other in the ways in which the language is spoken and written. For one to replace the other is more difficult. I guess it's then a question of whose space in between they are competing for.
Yes, I would be very unlikely to see one language or the other replace the other. But I think, you know, that the people don't really point this out, but this is one of the things I thought it was quite straightforward from a linguist's point of view. Chinese and English are rather similar languages in terms of word order and structure. You know, you have the subject and then the verb and then the object. So that thinking in Chinese and thinking in English are not that different in terms of the order of elements as you have to go through them. Where they do differ, of course, is in the writing system and indeed in the phonology, the system of sounds which makes one word different from another. Now, it's certainly the case that it's difficult for English people to learn Chinese going from any sort of written version, which is likely to be the way that they're taught it. But if they were to learn Chinese orally, it seems to me, and if they were to learn it earlier enough in life, it's quite possible that, as I say, these sort of similarities that there are between English and Chinese might have a quite unexpected force. But for that to happen, I think, people have to start moving away from written language. And this may be what we're seeing in our education systems, I don't know. As people get more and more in the way of technical support, it may be that the traditional skills of literacy will loom smaller, and you may well conceivably find it easier to learn Chinese as a result of that.
Well, this actually raises another interesting question, because I assume, again, from what you've written, that many of the effects on language were due to the difficulty of getting from one place to another. Certainly in the early days, when there were far fewer people, interaction was minimal. Now, well, we're fond of saying this is becoming a very small world. Technology, transportation, it's hard to remain isolated. What effect do you think that is going to have on the domination of languages?
Well, one effect it has is that, as never in the past, it's possible to be influenced by the spoken language of a completely different part of the world from you. You can see the action on TV and you can hear the description in the language going on. You can have chat shows which are now audible in China, but are being broadcast from Burbank or from Shepherd's Bush in London. So that means that there's a channel for the spread of oral language, and possibly this might even improve people's performance in learning languages across the world, since quite often it's young people and children who are most exposed in this way. So that is a difference. But what doesn't change, I think, is the fact that people actually live in their own communities with their own friends talking to them in a language where they feel comfortable. And there's no reason to suppose that people will en masse adopt the language of wider communication for those more intimate parts of their lives, I think.
So it's a variation on the immigration theory. You come in from the outside, but unless there is a reason for the local population to want that other language, whether it's religion or commerce, they're likely to stay with their own.
Well, yes. I mean, by inertia, they will do that. If they think it's particularly cool to learn somebody else's language, then, and that this obviously from the very nature of the word cool, this tends to be a generational thing, you may find that there's a shift takes place. But when it is a matter of youth culture, as people have often appealed, then, you know, people only stay young for a certain amount of time, and then they tend to switch back again. People made this point about Japanese culture a lot, that the old-style arts never seem to die away, although they're never popular with the young. People always come back to them later in life. Yeah. Now, of course, if you lose a language too thoroughly, you're not going to be able to come back to it.
Looking at the world today, of course, it's difficult to try to reason out what's going to happen, because these kind of changes take place over long periods of time. Mm. You don't establish the dominance of one language over another in the course of a decade or even...
Or even one generation.
Yeah. But looking at it now, you look back at what happened with English in India, for instance, and the importance of religion there. Looking at the world today, do you see forces that are more likely to push change than others?
Well, what's happening? I mean, communications are an important thing. And it is possible now to follow from anywhere in the world what's going on in the world as a whole. And you're likely to get your information through one or more of the languages of wider communication. Most likely, you will get that through English. But what we are seeing also is that areas of the world which in the 19th and early 20th centuries were areas for exploitation from the West are beginning to assert themselves on their own terms. And this is particularly happening in various parts of Asia. But we're also seeing it, I suppose, in South America, particularly in a place like Brazil. Now, that self-assertion by the other parts of the world, the fact that people are catching up in a way and maybe taking over in different parts of the world, is going to have a linguistic consequence. I mean, we've already seen the early effects of self-assertion by the Arab nations. This is not working out too well at the moment. But I think this is going to be a global phenomenon that we see, and often fueled much more by flexing of a sense of greater independent power than by senses of resentment. So I think it's a very challenging and interesting period that we confront, and we shall see languages like Hindi Urdu from India and indeed Arabic growing in importance, I'm confident, over the next 50 years.
Nicholas Oastler is the author of Empires of the Word, A Language History of the World. Here's Slim Gaylord with a language that never really caught on, a jive language he invented called Vout.
Yamra. Harise. Kibiseni ekibiba lahamis your mac voute. Yamra. Harise. Lahamishwe, lahamish voute, lahamisharunimo. Yamra. Harise. Kibiseni ekibiba and lahamis your own voute. Yamra. Harise. Votimo. Kibiseni, kibise voute, kibise voute. Chicka 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 guy, Allahu magfunimo. Masare ba urune yavra. Harise kibiseni ekibiba and lahamisha magvate yavra. Harise.
If you have ideas about what you'd like to hear on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org.
Harise, kibiseni ekibida and lahamisha magvante yebra. Harise, lahamishwe chili and tomato sauce vante. Harise, kibiseni ekibida and lahamisha magvante yebra. Harise, laham laho magvante mo. Kibiseni, kibise vante, kibise rute, kibise lam runi o vute laho vante mo. Super booty mocha, a little spice o' mag vosi, yabrak. Harise, kibise ni akibiba and lahamisha mag vote, yabrak. Harise.
Coming up, we're off to the movies for some dangerous films that changed history as we continue our hour on ideas. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Duke Ellington once said, "Art is dangerous. It is one of the attractions. When it ceases to be dangerous, you don't want it." And some of the most dangerous ideas have come to us through the most popular art form of our time, the motion picture. Just ask drive-in movie critic Joe Bob Briggs. Briggs is the author of profoundly disturbing, shocking movies that changed history. To the Best of Our Knowledge, producer Doug Gordon talked to Joe Bob Briggs about a few of these profoundly disturbing films.
What does Joe Bob Briggs mean by profoundly disturbing movies? They're movies your mama didn't want you to see. They're movies that went farther than the movies before them. They're disorienting movies or stunning movies or horrifying, but the bottom line is they rearrange what constitutes our view of what's normal or acceptable.
Movies like David Cronenberg's 1996 film, Crash.
It's about a world in which people have been so drained of emotion and ability to feel that the only way they can feel is through mutilation carried to the extreme, and in this case, car crashes.
Come on!
Beginning to see that for the first time there's a benevolent psychopathology that beckons towards us. For example, the car crash is a fertilizing rather than a destructive event, a liberation of sexual energy, mediating the sexuality of those who have died with an intensity that's impossible in any other form. To experience that, to live that is, that's my project.
There is a lot of Chevy petting going on in Crash. It's GM meets S&M. Briggs says that much of the film's shock value comes from director David Cronenberg's approach.
What he's done is he's filmed it so pristinely and sort of coldly and directly that it's trance-like. It really pulls you in. You're constantly saying, please don't go to that place. Please don't go to that place. And then he goes there, and then you think, oh, my God, but he had to go there. And so what's interesting to me about it is that critics forever have been saying, well, you can always just take the sex scenes out of a movie, and the movie's still there. Sex is always gratuitous. Now David Cronenberg makes a movie in which almost every scene is a sex scene, and if you remove any of the sex scenes, you lose the whole thread of the movie. Every sex scene is integral to the plot. It's integral to telling the story. In fact, the movie starts with three sex scenes, one after another, hardly any dialogue. And when the public first watched it, they were sort of like disoriented. What's going on here? When's the movie going to start? Well, the movie had started. You were learning a lot about these characters from the way they have sex. Now, he didn't get any credit for this. He made the first sex movie with no gratuitous sex in it. But in fact, he was vilified for this movie. It takes sex and drains all the emotion out of it, and it takes car crashes and makes them, instead of horrific, violent events, events full of positive emotion. So it turns the entire world upside down through these two kind of iconic things that are in every movie. It's disturbing.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence, the word and the act.
Most of the time, violence is golden at the box office. But that wasn't the case with Sam Peckinpah's 1969 Western, The Wild Bunch. Briggs describes The Wild Bunch as the American Hamlet.
It's so complex. It's so full of layers of text and subtext and countertext and all kinds of subliminal imagery and perversity. And it's about a gang of terrorists. These guys that we identify with in the movie are terrorists. Hamlet, though, was not an especially lovable guy. Wouldn't you say that's the case?
I would agree with that,
and
yeah.
Neither is Pike Bishop, who is the main character in The Wild Bunch. He's this broken-down, guilt-ridden boss of a gang of killers, and they're trudging wearily towards their doom in this wicked little Mexican town. The difference between Hamlet and Pike Bishop is Pike Bishop is not a man of many words. I mean, he hardly says anything. In the final sequence, he just says, let's go. And one of his men says, why not?
What happened the first time an audience saw The Wild Bunch?
It was a test screening in Kansas City, and about 30 people walked out within the first 10 minutes, which is understandable. The first thing is a terrorist act. At least one person reportedly threw up in the alley outside the theater. The movie was too long. It was 190 minutes long at that point. Peckinpah went back into this editing room and cut it down to 143. And then they took it to a special film festival in the Bahamas for a crowd in evening dress. They booed the film. They shouted at the screen. Peckinpah was there in the front row, so he stood up and yelled back at the sons of bitches, as he called them, and laced the theater with profanity. And so by the time it was released, it already had a reputation as the bloodiest, most violent, most sickening display of carnage ever made. What's interesting is normally that translates into a box office hit. Everybody wants to see it. But this film was disturbing on so many other levels that the word of mouth wasn't that good on it. People said it was depressing, it was not fun, it was kind of exhausting. But the people who loved it really, really loved it. And this is another one that filmmakers always put forth as one of the greatest American movies.
The Wild Bunch is a film with a lot of edits. There are 3,643 cuts, which is the record for a Technicolor film. Some of the cuts are as short as 3 frames, or 1/8 of a second. So short you can't even see them. Director Sam Peckinpah spent a year in the editing room, slicing and dicing. The Wild Bunch is also famous for its use of slow motion.
Peckinpah was not the first to use slow motion in a violent scene. Probably Akira Kurosawa was the first, but he was the first to use it this extensively, and he was criticized for that, to show the bodies slowly moving through the air and the blood squibs and the splatter and all that. However, what do we know now from what people say when they witness an accident or an earthquake or some kind of major shock in their lives? They all say the same thing. It was happening in slow motion. So psychologically, he was correct about the way these kinds of acts of violence are experienced. He made it possible for directors like Tarantino and Scorsese and others to use violent effects. Most of those directors, especially Scorsese and certainly Peckinpah, use the extreme violence as a way to show how horrific it is. So it's violence in the service of anti-violence, or at least that's what they would say. I believe that's true. I think it's much more feckless to use violence that has 500 dead bodies, but you never see any blood or anything. You know, that's what makes us inured to violence.
The 1971 film Shaft has quite a reputation in the world of profoundly disturbing cinema.
It's famous for many, many firsts. The boom in blaxploitation, the invention of badass black attitude, you know. It had the ultimate wah-wah rhythm and blues score. It changed music in the 70s. There were, like, many, many imitators. The depiction of New York sort of became the standard depiction, you know, the Darwinian cesspool New York. But there's one that I've never seen mentioned, which is it invented pedestrian terrorism. The opening shot of the film, Shaft emerges from the subway in Times Square. He's wearing that black leather trench coat and his beige cashmere turtleneck, and he strides across Manhattan like he owns the place. And he's never so uncool as to actually pay attention to traffic. The cars can just bloody well adapt to him, and death to the motorist who doesn't. So this was such an important stylistic detail to the director, Gordon Parks, that he told Richard Roundtree, the star, never to look to the side when he crossed the street. Well, Roundtree was made a little nervous by this because he was raised in the suburbs. He's really not that comfortable on the streets. He's from New Rochelle, home of Robin Laura Petrie, for God's sake, you know. And so he actually went out every day and practiced, you know, checking his peripheral vision to see how much he could know about the cars without looking and how aggressive he could be without getting run down. So in that famous opening shot with the theme from Shaft playing, Parks put the camera up on top of a Times Square building and he shot without closing the street. So when Shaft almost gets hit by a cab there in the opening scene and he flips the cab off, that's Richard Roundtree almost getting hit by a cab. And he just stayed in character and did that little move. After it was released, The streets of New York would never be the same because every little kid and teenager wanted to be a badass like that. And so they adopted that walk and that style and that swagger and that indifference to traffic and also the rather stilted lingo that they used in the movie. If ever a single movie transformed a whole youth culture, at least for a few years, Shaft was that movie. Not just black culture either, white culture as well. There was, I think the audience for Shaft was something like 70% white.
Joe Bob Briggs is the author of profoundly disturbing, shocking movies that changed history. He spoke with, to the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon. Coming up, we'll explore the experimental literary world of British novelist B.S. Johnson as we conclude our hour on ideas. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Jonathan Coe is a novelist, but he's also a biographer. Coe won the BBC Four Samuel Johnson Prize for Nonfiction 2005 for his book Like a Fiery Elephant, The Story of B.S. Johnson. Johnson was a British writer who was very active during the 1960s and 70s, and he tried to constantly reinvent the novel with every book he wrote. As his biographer, Jonathan Coe, told Anne Strangehamps.
His hero was Laurence Sterne, who, when he wrote Tristram Shandy in the 1750s, already did, actually, right at the beginning of the novel's evolution as a form, everything that could be done in terms of deconstructing it and parodying it and taking it apart and putting back together again. Johnson kind of took his cue from Sterne and tried to apply some of his techniques to a more realistic mode of writing. So, for instance, in his first novel, when a character is about to lose consciousness, then have a heart attack and die, he does this by the words that the character is speaking on the page slowly blurring and breaking up, then shading to grey, then the grey getting darker and darker, and then turning to black. So what you have at the end is an absolutely black page, which signifies the guy's loss of consciousness and death. In his next novel, Alban Angelo, where he wanted readers to have a kind of flash-forward vision of a future event which would take place a few pages on in the novel, what he did was to cut holes, or get his printers to cut holes, through the pages of the novel, so that when you're on, for instance, page 73, you can see through to page 77 or whatever. And most radically, I guess, in his novel The Unfortunates, which was published in the late 60s, he wanted it to be a book about the way that memory operates in the human mind and how it interacts with the impressions that we receive every day in the present. And he conceived of this as being an entirely random process, a process over which the conscious mind has no control, and to make the reader experience this randomness for himself or herself, he insisted that the pages were published unbound in a box rather than in a regular bound sequential book, so that you could shuffle the pages and read the chapters of the novel in any order that chance happened to deliver them to you in.
That's wonderful. So he was a very Dadaist sort of writer. How did this go over with the public?
He never reached a big readership in his lifetime, which I think was unlucky, actually, because there's nothing, despite the adventurousness of these novels and the fact that they do things which more conventional novels don't do, they are highly accessible and highly readable. What makes them that way is the fact that Johnson is constantly opening himself to the reader. They're very honest books, and they're also highly autobiographical. He did get involved in some kind of arguments over terminology with his publishers, who believed that what he was really writing was a series of memoirs, because most of his most important books are books about himself, about things that happened to him in his childhood, about important friendships, important relationships. They are a kind of highly wrought and highly literary autobiography.
Given that he was doing so much playing with form, are the books, do they have plots? Are there stories in them?
That's a question that would have enraged B.S. Johnson. He had great difficulty with the word story, and even greater difficulty with the word plot. He believed that the duty of the novelist was to be as faithful to reality as possible. He also believed, quite rightly, of course, that reality does not consist of plots. Reality does not really have a shape. Reality doesn't really consist of story in the sense that novelists conceive of it. And he felt that it was unfaithful to reality and dishonest with the reader if you tried to tie things up neatly at the end of a novel, if you tried to resolve things, even if you tried to egg readers on with plot devices, with cliffhangers, with suspense, all the kind of tricks, as he would see it, that a lesser novelist might employ.
What does he write about then?
He writes about himself, he writes about his own memories, and he writes about the most important friendships and relationships in his life. That's what he does in most of his books. Occasionally, in a novel like Christy Mallory's Own Double Entry, he will tell a story, but he kind of lets himself off the hook, as he sees it when he does that, by constantly telling the reader that it's a story, constantly discussing the story with the reader, making jokes about the fact that he's making this stuff up and it didn't really happen. At moments like that, he becomes a very kind of reflexive and postmodern writer, but in a highly amusing and engaging way.
Do you have a favorite excerpt from one of his novels that you might be able to read to us?
Well, what I've brought along to read actually is not an extract from one of his novels, but an extract from an essay he wrote. Almost the last thing that he wrote at the end of his life, in fact, the introduction to a collection of short pieces he wrote, called, rather amusingly and appropriately, considering what we've been talked about, the title of this collection is "Aren't You Rather Young to Be Writing Your Memoirs?" which is what his publisher said to him when, at the age of, in his mid-30s, I suppose, he started writing this autobiographical sequence. So if it's okay with you, I'll read a few paragraphs from that.
Yes, please.
Okay. Literary forms do become exhausted, clapped out as well. Look what happened to five-act blank-verse drama by the beginning of the 19th century. Keats, Shelley, Wordsworth and Tennyson all wrote blank-verse, quasi-Elizabethan plays, and all of them, without exception, are resounding failures. They are so not because the men who wrote them were inferior poets, but because the form was finished, worn out, exhausted, and everything that could be done with it had been done too many times already. This is what seems to have happened to the 19th century narrative novel, too, by the outbreak of the First World War. No matter how good the writers are who now attempt it, it cannot be made to work for our time, and the writing of it is anachronistic, invalid, irrelevant, and perverse. The novelist cannot legitimately or successfully embody present-day reality in exhausted forms. Present-day reality is changing rapidly. It always has done, but for each generation it appears to be speeding up. Novelists must evolve by inventing, borrowing, stealing, or cobbling from other media forms which will more or less satisfactorily contain an ever-changing reality, their own reality, and not Dickens's reality or Hardy's reality or even James Joyce's reality. Present-day reality is markedly different from, say, 19th century reality. Then it was possible to believe in pattern and eternity. But today what characterizes our reality is the probability that chaos is the most likely explanation. Samuel Beckett, who of all living is the man I believe most worth reading and listening to, is reported thus. What I'm saying does not mean that there will henceforth be no form in art. It only means that there will be new form, and that this form will be of such a type that it admits the chaos and does not try to say that the chaos is really something else. To find a form that accommodates the mess, that is the task of the artist now.
Jonathan, you're a novelist yourself. Do you agree with him?
What I agree with B.S. Johnson about is that reality is ever-changing. and that you can't satisfactorily write about life in the early 21st century in the way that Dickens or George Eliot were writing about reality in the 19th century. In particular, I think that the narrative voice that they adopted, this Olympian, omniscient, third-person narrative voice, is very difficult for a writer to adopt now. Readers expect more intimacy than that. Readers expect to get closer to the characters. A vastly larger number of novels these days are written in the first person, I would guess, than the third person. And also, Johnson was right in a way that I think readers are getting less and less interested in the idea of writers making things up, writers imposing patterns on reality, when what they want is something a bit more faithful, a bit more authentic than that. Hence, among other things, I think we can see the incredible rise in popularity of personal memoirs.
Will you tell me something about how B.S. Johnson died? He committed suicide at the age of 40.
He was 40, yes. And, you know, he was clearly going through a very bad period of depression. He'd had a number of depressive episodes earlier in his life. This one was particularly severe. He was drinking very heavily. His marriage was in serious trouble. His literary career was not going well. It had begun on a kind of huge wave of critical acclaim and optimism on Johnson's part, and that was slowly sort of fizzling out. He became increasingly paranoid and insecure about what was happening in his personal life and what was happening in his professional life. And one weekend, his wife left him, taking their children, their two children, with her. And she made it clear to him, or thought she'd made it clear to him, that this was a temporary thing, that she just wanted time to get away and think things through, and that they both needed a few days or weeks apart. But he didn't see it like that. He thought that this was in the nature of a final separation. And that idea was completely unacceptable to him because his marriage was the bedrock of his life at that point. He wandered around the house for a couple of days by himself, drinking increasingly heavily, and then he ran a warm bath and cut his wrists. And that was how his wife found him when she came back to the house a couple of days later.
Did he leave a suicide note?
He left a card which consisted of four words. On the top line it said, "This is my last," sorry, five words. On the top line it said, "This is my last," and underneath that it said, "Word."
Jonathan Coe is the author of the award-winning biography, Like a Fiery Elephant, The Story of B.S. Johnson. Coe spoke with N. Strange Chimps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 226B, Ideas. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Ann Strange Chimps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickard. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.